Welcome to the midday for a Friday. I'm Norman Gilliland with my jazz voice again today. And with me is Chuck Dellenbach, who is always in voice because he is with the Canadian Brass, and not just with the Canadian Brass, but one of the founding members, one of the two founding members, and the only one still performing with the Canadian Brass. And he also is from Wisconsin. Welcome to the midday.
Thank you.
How many Canadians are in the Canadian Brass these days? You get asked that often?
Well, we do. We get asked that constantly. And of the five of us, we have four Americans and two Canadians.
Okay.
Well, there's a couple of duels in there.
I was going to say, some backups. And how did the whole Canadian connection begin? You were in Toronto.
Right after college, I'd gone to the Eastman School in New York State. And my first job in life after college was teaching at the University of Toronto. And prior to my first day of teaching, I met trombonist Gene, who became my 40-year colleague. We founded the Canadian Brass. Of course, not having any idea where it would lead, but it was at first with very modest intentions, just the opportunity to perform and play and play music that we loved.
You eventually have to find some kind of a niche, don't you? Some kind of a branding in order to make your way in the music world.
Well, particularly with brass, there was no path when we started. In 1970, no one had heard of brass quintets as a viable career path. So we really were starting on the ground floor in many respects, which turns out to be very, very fortunate. We were not constricted or bound by rules and regulations where, say, a typical string quartet, there's repertoire you must play and everybody insists on it, and a certain way that you must conduct your concert and so forth. Well, we didn't have those boundaries.
What about the repertory then? How much repertory was there for a brass quintet when you came along in 1970?
Well, the very first brass quintet of note was the Chicago Symphony Brass Quintet from the very late 40s. So they had established the format, two trumpets, French horn, trombone, and tuba. But their occupation really was orchestra first and quintet third, no second. So the repertoire was very slim. We had maybe two or three pieces that people felt important to play. And even those we judged to be maybe class B or C compared to a string quartet piece. So we decided to just simply take a masterpiece approach, taking a leaf out of Johann Sebastian Bach's book. We were not afraid to transcribe and arrange, but we were very careful to make sure that it was music that we loved, music that would make the translation well and not just remind people of the original, and make sure that it was really the highest quality. We thought if we're borrowing the music anyway, why not just take the very best?
Did you get a lot of Christmas gigs? I mean, isn't brass often associated with this time of year?
Well, we've kind of decided that Christmas and Canadian brass became synonymous. We were very fortunate early on to make a Christmas recording with the St. Patrick's Cathedral organ in New York City, and a glorious album that it was. And that, I think to this day, is probably the best-selling recording ever, just because of the fact that it was such a glorious sound and really introduced brass in a major way to the Christmas.
And that brass and organ sound persists.
It's absolutely perfect relation.
Well, let's hear a little bit of one of your older recordings. And there are, what, 100 CDs now?
Yes.
I wonder that you even have time to sit here and talk to me. Well, you're recording one probably in the next hour or two, I assume.
Well, that was the advantage of being right here with all these microphones. We'll probably...
Yeah. we haven't even mentioned what your instrument is in this.
Well, I'm the tuba player in the group. Perhaps hence the longevity. You know, tuba is the largest instrument, the largest mouthpiece, so... I sometimes wonder, the trumpet player is a very small mouthpiece, a lot of control, a lot of pressure.
Right.
You know, I think it was the right choice. It turned out just by luck.
I was going to say, prior to a brass quintet, the gigs for a tuba player would be kind of limited, wouldn't they?
Not only limited, but a certain role. You'd be in large orchestras and large bands. Even the big era, the swing bands, I suppose from the 40s and 50s, they're always pictured with a tuba in the back of the band. But of course, that waned.
Yeah.
Now you're seeing a resurgence. The typical late night show, you look at the band, and in the end, they have a sousaphone player.
Oh, really?
Which is a whole new role for the tuba, but that's...
Well, I know that way back 100 years ago, early in recording, when the original part would call for, a string bass, they needed something louder than that to play into the recording horn, so they'd substitute a tuba.
Well, you probably know that they found out later that it wasn't the pickup of the sound, it was the playback. So now when you listen back to some of these, particularly out of Los Angeles, all of these film recordings and so forth, that had the tuba as a reinforcing bass instrument, they almost become tuba concerti recordings.
You have a way of taking over with an instrument that size. This is one of, I wouldn't call it necessarily one of your trademark pieces, but it's one that lends itself really well, I think, to this brass quintet sound, music by Henry Purcell. And we'll hear some of his suite from Abdelazar, Canadian Brass.
Thank you.
some of Henry Purcell's music for Abdelazar or the Moor's Revenge, theater music, London in the 1690s, as played by Canadian Brass, an ensemble that has been around for 43 years now, and the tuba player is blowing the same, I was going to say the same instrument. Has your instrument changed in 43 years, Chuck?
Oh, quite a bit, but the voice is the same.
And do you have, out of these 100 CDs the Canadian Brass has performed, if I were to say, you know, what are some of your favorites or your fondest memories of recording them? Are there a couple of those 100 that would come to mind pretty readily?
Well, I think anybody that has a family, if you have children, more than one child, you know how difficult it is to pick your favorite child. It just puts you through a terrible process.
Right. Sure. But memorable occasions in the recording?
Well, I would say, just about every recording has some story behind it that would be more or less either intriguing or amazing. The recording process itself is both a pressure cooker and a great creative opportunity. And the piece we just listened to, for example, really started exploring the value of a piccolo trumpet in the quintet. That was an instrument that was really an accent instrument prior to Canadian Brass. And our trumpet player at that time, Fred Mills, really created a role for piccolo trumpet to the point where now, at first it was colleges and now even high school, invariably you'll find the fine trumpet player has a piccolo trumpet in his case as well. It's become an absolute mandatory instrument.
Well, that actually asks another question, doesn't it? That is, how many different instruments Canadian Brass play?
Well, the lower instruments, the tuba, trombone, French horn, pretty much stick to one instrument. Trombone, of course, is 100% compatible with a baritone horn. So many recordings will have baritone, but traveling with it is a little bit cumbersome, so you seldom see it in a live concert. But trumpets will always have the piccolo trumpet. Their standard instrument is the B-flat trumpet that you'd see on television or any place. But additionally to that, they'll have a flugelhorn for the warm, open sound, and then a piccolo trumpet. And one of them might carry an E-flat trumpet as well, which is positioned perfectly between the B-flat and the piccolo, halfway in between, which makes the higher tessitura, particularly for Baroque music, gives it a very brilliant sound.
And now, do you do as some early music ensembles do, actually switch instruments during a performance? I mean, during the performance of a particular piece?
Yes, that happens too often from my point of view. But yes, it's really picking the appropriate instrument. The other thing that we have done, which I think right now is unique to our ensemble, is we've been introducing rotary trumpets, which is the European standard trumpet. It would have been the trumpet that composers such as Mahler and Bruckner,
Strauss maybe,
yes, would have been used to hearing in their music. And it's a little warmer sound. The B-flat trumpet in Europe, the standard American B-flat piston valve trumpet, is considered more of a jazz instrument, where here it's the standard classical as well as jazz. So we've adopted a little bit of the warmer European concept as well to bring a little more, I guess you'd say, authenticity sometimes to this European music.
Now you, and I, when I say you, I mean both you, Chuck Dallenbach, but also the Canadian Brass, actually were engaged in some diplomatic breakthroughs.
We were I think we're still viewed a bit as ambassadors, musical ambassadors for Canada. It was a role that we didn't expect, but I guess by selecting the name early on, Canadian Brass, it just became important that we uphold the values as we were traveling to the Canadian flag. So when the China was just opening up, then Prime Minister Pierre Elliott Trudeau had created an exchange program where China was going to send their opera, Beijing Opera, The White-Haired Girl, to Canada. And then in return, Canada was going to send a large ensemble. China got a little nervous about starting with a large ensemble. And one of the people in the diplomatic corps in China immediately said, well, we have an idea. Let's do an experiment. First, we'll send in Canadian Brass. So in 1977, right at the end of the Cultural Revolution, so-called Cultural Revolution, we went to China. We were the first Western musicians in. And more than that, at that time, Americans could not go to China. So we were really in a highly, under a microscope, I would say.
Yeah.
And the...
Did you have to know how to play ping pong?
Ping pong. We had to know how to... well, there was a journalist with us that was actually supplying the New York Times information because it had to be a Canadian journalist. An American journalist couldn't be there.
Sure, sure.
So we had this fellow, Ross Monroe, dog the entire tour, and he saw political repercussions to absolutely everything we did, and we'd never thought about a concert in that light. But he was very aware of which politicians were showing up, and at one time, Mao Zedong's lieutenant, I think Deng, had showed up to one of our concerts, which to him was just groundbreaking. And we wouldn't have noticed that without his pointing this out.
Did you have to choose your repertory very carefully?
They went through the repertoire, and they particularly were taking out things like early American jazz, like Dixieland, for example.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you know why?
Well, I think there's a bit of a relationship to Dixieland. Often was premiered, where the writers were getting work was often strip clubs and houses of ill repute.
Okay, so it was the cultural, historical association.
Yet we had several pieces that maybe they didn't recognize as being early American jazz or Dixieland, so they were on the program. So,
I mean, the Chinese, what would you say, absorption of Western music to this day has some curious manifestations. When I was in Beijing a few years ago, every morning on the top of the apartment building nearby, there was a group of Chinese who were doing their morning exercises, and the music they always had was Jingle Bells.
<That's>
and we're talking about, October or something,
right.
So their perception of Western music is still, I suspect, a little different from what we would have.
Well, we were fortunate in that our concerts were recorded, and we were told that we were being played on the trains in China for 10 years after we had made that appearance. So our music became the representation of Western art culture for quite a long time. This may be a good or bad thing, but we certainly did influence Chinese music.
Yeah, that's spectacular. Congratulations. We've been talking about the early days, the 70s of the brass. By the time you went to China in 77, did you have that distinctive look that you have now with the black suits and the running shoes?
We had just embarked on our ballet career, so it was not yet the standard logo shoe of the Canadian Brass yet, but we were wearing the Capizio white ballet slippers. They were the jazz slippers that have leather soles, and everybody thought we were wearing running shoes, and we thought, well, running shoes are much more comfortable, and they think we're wearing them anyway, so we switched.
That does actually sometimes come useful, though, in a performance. It's not as if you just stand still when you play.
We have tried to, we call it staging. It's not really theatrics or anything, but staging and trying to always find the best way to relay a piece of music. Most often it's sitting as you might expect, from 200 years of string quartets, just sitting in a in a horseshoe and playing music with even music stands in front of us. But some music demands much more, and certainly when we started early American jazz, particularly Dixieland and so forth, you really need to be up and around, standing and really featuring solos, stepping forward a little bit.
Sure.
And just making yourself a little more available and make it more obvious even to an audience on first listening where the important lines are and so forth. So it's a way to really illuminate or underscore the important part of the music.
Now, correct me if my memory is faulty, but I have this image of one of the brass, perhaps even the tuba player at one point, on his back performing.
No, that was... yes, okay, that was me.
Are you still doing that kind of
thing? Well, it's sort of become obligatory. If people don't see me on the stage floor at least once, they're disappointed.
Well, okay, that's something else to look forward to. This is going to take us down to our quiz question, and I don't know how many of these transcriptions of this particular quartet's music you have done, but I imagine there are a fair number of them.
Well, we discovered this German rock and roll group that got very famous. I guess they moved to England after they got started as the Beatles. And what was interesting about the Beatles is they really changed rock and roll.
They did.
Turned it into a more of a cultural event. And one of the ways they did it was by introducing what we call orchestral instruments, acoustic instruments, into their arrangements. Pianos, violins, cellos. And one piece featured a trumpet that was so high that at that time, not that I was there, I mean, people tell me, at that time, everybody thought it was electronic, that a trumpet couldn't play that high. And now, as you'll hear, it's become an extended trumpet solo and is played live, and it's quite an amazing virtuoso piece for trumpet.
Taking us to just past 12:30 in our quiz question, you'll recognize those high notes. It can be done by an actual human playing an actual human instrument, that high note.
We actually bumped into the original Penny Lane piccolo trumpet player, Mason, in London, England. And he heard us play the Penny Lane, and it was such a nice comment he made to our trumpet player. He said, "I'm certainly glad you weren't around when they were doing this. I only had to play for a few seconds."
Yeah, you kind of put it into a whole different realm there. Well, we're going to have more from Chuck Dellenbach and Canadian Brass, and we'll also be sampling their, I think, is it your latest this Christmas CD?
Yes, it is. Brand new.
And we'll be, even in fact, I can tip the hand and say that we're going to be giving one of those away as part of our treasure trove with our quiz question prize today. How about a change of pace here, Chuck? I mean, with 100 CDs of the Canadian Brass to work with, should be a little variety to work from. And you mentioned that there's another, at least one more member of the Brass from Wisconsin.
Well, Bernard Scully, a French hornist, very, very fine French hornist, played with us for several years, and he is a graduate of the University of Wisconsin right here in Madison. And he played in the very orchestra we're going to be playing
with tomorrow. The Wisconsin Chamber Orchestra.
Exactly. He went on to play in the Minnesota Chamber Orchestra and is now a sought-after teacher. He's really a prime teacher of horn. He studied with Doug Hill here at the university.
Yes, long-time horn player here.
Exactly. And Doug was a colleague of mine way back when in Rochester. Doug was the principal horn of the Rochester Philharmonic prior to coming here. And it was interesting when you close these little circles, it's really quite amazing. But that's the wonder and wonderful nature of the music business, is that it is a very small community.
Yes, community is the word, isn't it? You travel around the world and you run into people you know or you've performed with.
Right.
And so this is the Ave Verum Corpus of Mozart and Canadian Brass. Ave Verum Corpus, Canadian Brass, with a couple of Wisconsinites playing in that particular rendition. And I think let's go ahead and, before we get back to Chuck Dallenbach, who's the tuba player, tubist with the Wisconsin, with the Wisconsin Chamber Orchestra, but it's Canadian Brass too, and more about that. He's one of the founding members, the only founding member still performing with the group after 43 years. All of that and the repeat of today's 12:30 quiz question after this here on WPR. Back with Chuck Dallenbach and the Canadian Brass. Is there a composer who would be represented more than any other in these 100 CDs of the brass?
Well, we didn't actually discuss this prior to you asking me the question, but that should have been a quiz question. Bach, of course. Bach is central to so many musicians' understanding of so-called Western art music. It just creates so many opportunities for musical expression, musical investigation. So Bach has been a constant companion. And one of the, you talked about recording stories, one was we were very enamored of the Art of the Fugue, a very long work that investigates every possibility of working with a fugue. So we were playing the first Art of the Fugue for our producer at that time, early on, and it starts with a fifth, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. We played the entire piece. We played our hearts out. And in the end, she said, you know, when you played the first three notes, I thought you were going to play the little fugue in G minor.
Of course, yep.
So, well, you could have saved us a lot of time. but that put us on to the little fugue by Bach, which is a perfect fugue and has become, I would say, both a very important work for Canadian Brass. It has permeated our career. But we are also told by many music teachers that it's a wonderful example of fugue style. It is so straightforward, and with the brass instruments, it's much easier to follow the lines through the fugue as an exploration of how a fugue works.
And so, before we get into it, who does, in fact, your transcriptions? There's so many of them.
We do some of the transcriptions ourselves, but generally we have had some very wonderful writers to work with. On the classical side, Arthur Frackenpole, wonderful name.
Distinctive.
He was a professor of composition at the State University of New York in Potsdam. He supplied many of our major works, the entire Art of the Fugue, a Wagner album that actually Ado de Vart conducted.
Oh, Ado, another Wisconsin name.
Exactly.
Sure.
A lot of connections.
Yeah.
Which we did with the Bayreuth Festival Orchestra brass players. He did a lot of the classical things, and then Luther Henderson put us in touch with the entire jazz tradition of North America.
Oh, I would think so.
Yeah. Right. And then Fred Mills, our trumpet player, I think he created maybe over 40 arrangements for us, and then this particular little fugue, which I think we're going to hear, was transcribed for us by Ronald Rahm, our other trumpet player.
And here it is then, that little fugue in G minor by Bach, Canadian Brass, from about 1993. interviewed Ton Copeman once a long time ago, and he was making a distinction between Bach and other composers, and he said that when you transcribe, and it was an interesting turn of phrase, he said when you transcribe music of Bach, you know, it just comes through so beautifully, but when you just transcribe music of a lot of other composers, he says the music is away. Mm-hmm. And there is something about Bach that you can, I mean, you can play it on the harmonica and it's still, right. there's something compelling that comes through.
No, I don't agree. I tried it on harmonica.
Well, it depends on who the harmonica player is.
There you go.
But on tuba, it sounds pretty good there. That was the little fugue in G minor, and that was from the disc called The Essential Canadian Brass that came out about 1993. Projects that how could there be anything remaining when you've done 100 CDs? But are there projects that you say, boy, we've been wanting to do this for years?
Exactly. There's no end to the possibilities. And with creative people, and usually musicians that are skilled, they are having many, many ideas of what they can do with these skills and things that intrigue them. The Beatles project, the Penny Lane we played earlier, when we did produce a Beatles project, many people would say to us, well, I thought you already did that. It was so obvious, it seemed.
Oh, it fits so well
it
with
fits
the
so
brass
well.
Sound.
Yeah. And another one is everybody thinks that we have done a CD project on movie themes.
Oh.
It seems so logical and obvious, yet we have not done that. So,
are you going to do that?
Well, you never know. You never know. There's so much good John Williams, for example.
There is. Well, earlier this morning, for that matter, we heard Lieutenant Kijé. That's got some great brass stuff in it just to start with.
Well, we think that the orchestra repertoire, one danger with orchestra repertoire, and I'll talk a little bit about arrangement, is it's so glorious in its original form that a transcription will remind an audience of when they heard that and were really thrilled with the music.
It's always the danger, isn't it?
Right.
Where's the violin?
Exactly. So we've been very careful to make sure that our pieces of music are ones that we can illuminate from another angle. We think of it like a statue, for example. It's not a one-dimensional thing. You can walk around that statue and see it in many different lights. And with music, we feel like the original has to stand up to that kind of scrutiny and not simply remind you of the original.
Sure. Yeah, well, that's got to be a challenge, too, even for the Canadian brass. Mm-hmm. Well, we mentioned this Christmas CD a couple of times, and we're going to hear...
Thank you very much. Thank you.
A couple of examples from that. It's called Christmas Time Is Here, Canadian brass with some other performers brought in, which you often do.
We often bring in other musicians we think will help, again, illuminate the music in some different way. But this is primarily a brass quintet recording. And then we borrowed an old friend that is part of the Nexus percussion ensemble to come in and add percussion sounds. Not in the sense of adding drums, but adding chimes and bells and things that would just bring some of these pieces even more to life. And then we relied a bit on the Charlie Brown Christmas that was in all of our background somewhere.
Oh, yes.
And brought some of those pieces to our repertoire.
So we're actually going to segue here from one to the other. What Child Is This? And then the first track on the CD, which is Christmas Is Coming from the Christmas Times Here. It's Canadian Brass. Pieces from Christmas Time Is Here, Canadian Brass. It's their latest CD. And we heard What Child Is This? And just now, Christmas is coming. And a pleasure having Chuck Dallenbach, tuba player and founding member of Canadian Brass, with us. Great to have you.
Thanks so much.
Performing two concerts, the Canadian Brass is tomorrow. That's November 30th, 2 p.m. and 8 p.m. The Middleton Performing Arts Center, that's at Middleton High School, performing with the Wisconsin Chamber Orchestra.